And unfortunately, so many people go through this and then they think, ah, PT doesn't work. PT doesn't, like, this stuff is just crap. Like, I'd rather just go to my trainer, rather go to my chiropractor. And again, I don't have anything wrong with, chiros or personal trainers, but I mean, it's embarrassing what happens a lot in our profession.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Basketball Strong Podcast. I'm Tim DeFrancesco, former LA Lakers strength and conditioning coach and doctor of physical therapy, and I'm here with my co-host, Emmy-nominated writer and author, Phil White. This podcast is not just for basketball junkies. It's for anyone who loves to hear the human stories behind great people while learning the science behind preparing your body for the court and high performance. Today's guest is Dr. Caleb Burgess. Caleb grew up playing the game of basketball, and then he turned his competitive fire to becoming an elite physical therapist. You can follow Caleb on Instagram at dr.caleb.burgess. That's at dr.caleb.burgess. In this episode, we cover everything from the injuries that he had to fight through during his own playing career, all the way to pain science and the soft skills that it takes to be an elite clinician and physical therapist. Let's get into the conversation. Caleb, tell us a little bit about your playing days and what that was like coming up, and then how that turned into you becoming a doctor of physical therapy and helping on the other side for players and people.
I'll start with high school. I went to a small Christian private school in Southern California that really wasn't like any sort of like powerhouse or anything, but it was one of those things where I was there since I was in kindergarten. I had a lot of really close friends. I had always looked up to the guys when I was a little kid, like playing at that school. And like I said, not like we were anything special, but it was very cool to have that environment and that small school feel. I actually almost transferred to, not like a lot of guys will transfer to bigger schools to get more exposure. So I was going to do that, but it was like my senior year and all my buddies, like we were so tight, so close. And I was like, you know what? It's just not going to be worth it for me to do that. I got to figure something else out with travel ball, AAU, that kind of stuff. And right. Even AAU, I was that guy who I played multiple sports. I played soccer and baseball as well. And to me, like I had buddies that like would literally travel like to different, like always changing schools, like always changing, hopping to the next school that was like the big name school. And like, to me, they're always moving. And I was like, I don't know if my dad didn't really want to do that. My mom didn't want to do that. As a little kid, I was like, I don't want to do that.
Right.
I was like, I want to play basketball and have fun. So I didn't really do that. And I stayed at the same school. And so it ended up working out. I started playing AAU ball when I was like a junior or sophomore in high school, like way late. So nobody knew who the heck I was. I wasn't crazy good, but I would say I was definitely above average. And I ended up playing. I got lucky that I got spotted by some of the scouts for some smaller NAIA schools. Azusa Pacific was where I ended up going.
Yep.
I think I had a game where I hit like 8 threes in a row, and their scout was like, all right, we need this guy.
Wow.
And so I just got kind of lucky because nobody knew who I was. It was kind of like if someone's there to see somebody else, and if I show out for a few games, then maybe I'll get some offers. So that's basically what happened. I ended up playing there for 4 years, and then I went to PT school at the same school the 3 years after. And a lot of that decision was because I met my wife when I was 18. She wasn't my wife, obviously. I was not thinking about that at all.
Right.
But she was in nursing school still when I graduated. So I didn't really want to leave her to go somewhere else. So I only applied to one school, and our program was pretty good there. So I was there for all the 7 years. And then going kind of back, I'm kind of going back and forth here. My freshman and sophomore year playing was good. I was kind of like getting used to having a lot higher level play. But I didn't adjust quick enough to what I should have been doing. Like I should have been getting a lot more minutes when I was a freshman and a sophomore, but I didn't really, I think coming from that small school vibe where you're like the man like at your school,
right?
And not really being at a school or at a bigger school where you're facing a lot, really good competition all the time. Like, I think I thought I was better than I was. And so I didn't know how hard I had to work to actually just get in the rotation.
Understood.
And so my my junior year, I was like, screw this. I'm gonna get somehow get in the starting lineup or at least in the, like the main rotation here. And I worked my butt off. And then that year, actually, a transfer came in, the nicest guy in the world, super talented. He was in my position. He was going to be the starter. I was going to be the backup for him. He tore his ACL in one of our preseason kind of like scrimmages. Wow. And so he tore his ACL. And then I was like, boom, I was in the starting lineup. And I literally, for the whole year, I was in the main rotation, logging probably one of the most minutes on the team. And I got to actually kind of get used to being one of the main guys again, which it was weird the first couple of years not being one of the main guys like I was used to being. So I got to do that. My junior year went to the national championship, lost by 1 point. We actually made the winning basket. But my buddy, he was tipping the ball on the rebound at the very end. And he was scrambling for it. He got it off. They had to do a instant replay. It was on his fingertips. When it went off. So we would have won by 1 point, and we ended up losing by 1 point.
No.
Yeah. So, and as for like an NAI, like I know they televise, I think like the semifinals and the national championship. Yeah. So for us, it was big. It was a big deal, right?
It was huge. Normally have
that stuff. So that took a really long time to get over that. I mean, even my dad even still talks about it today. You bring it up and my dad gets like, tell he gets like stressed out and like pissed. And then I'm just like, Dad, it's over. Like, it's fine. Like, life goes on.
Right.
Anyway, that was the farthest we got. My senior year, we actually had a better team, but we ended up losing in the quarterfinals. And the team that we lost to ended up winning the whole thing. So we lost to So we were up by like 13 points in the first half, and then we gave it away. Yeah.
Got it.
So talk to us a little bit about the motivation. Obviously, you said why you wanted to stay at the same school in the PT program, but what was it about the human body or movement that really motivated you to commit to that second part of your academic journey there?
Well, I kind of have a similar story to a lot of physical therapists, which is you have some injuries that have a big effect on your life. I didn't even mention those, both related to basketball. You have some big injuries. You have a really good experience, or you have a really bad experience. If you have a bad experience, you want to try to do something to make it better, potentially. Right. If you have a really good experience, you're like, man, I want to help people in that same way. So for me, I had some really good experiences at like a sports physical therapy facility when I was 14 or 15, and I was a sophomore in high school, and I was like really like so pumped to be ready to kind of help out, because our school had not been doing well basketball wise for like years before that.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a kid, you're kind of cocky. And I was kind of like, man, when I get in there, we're going to turn things around. And we had some decent teams those years, but anyway, the preseason, I went up for a layup. I got undercut, not cheap shot. Just the guy was smaller than me, taking a charge. And I was all the way up going sideways, watching my shot go in like I was taught to do. And I extended my arm out at the top of my jump. My body was fully horizontal and I locked my elbow. And when I hit the ground, my radial head just snapped off and lodged in the back of my tricep region. I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know that. But I was like, I remember my hand was just doing this. Like, I could not, people that can't see it, it was just shaking. And I kind of had it in that like cast position.
Wow.
And I remember it was the most extreme pain ever. I was like, smacking the ground, rolling around, you know, that you normally see if something that happens like that. I go to the bench and my coach, I mean, the nicest guy in the world, but he goes, shake it off, try moving it around. And I'm like, I can't move my arm. I tried to like straighten it out and it was literally, I can't even describe it. It's kind of that feeling where you kind of go outside of your body, like it was so intense. And my hand, literally, it was like shaking like tremors. And I remember we went to the hospital and then they told me what happened. I ended up having two surgeries on my arm. I had like five pins. They tried to get the cartilage because all the cartilage of my humerus was sheared, not all of it, but a bunch of it was sheared off because it hit hard. So I had five pins and then they had to go back in and not redo it, but take the pins out. I don't know how many months later. But if you actually look, if I'm showing you right now, I can't supinate my hands. So I can't go palm up. And I had to play college basketball with that. When I'm shooting layups, I'm right-handed, or when I'm trying to lay up, I have to like twist my hand all weird every time. So it kind of screwed up with that a little bit. I had to kind of learn how to adapt. And then even my shooting, my pronation, so people that understand, it's palm down.
Yeah.
It's almost there, but like even when I shoot, like if you look at this side, my left side, I can get here. This one I have to kind of
very like different
turn my hand weird. So it screwed up my shot a little bit. But I mean, obviously your body is really good at adapting, as you know. So I know I became a lot better shooter than I even was beforehand, but there's that thing in the back of your head that goes, those shooting like slumps I was in, would I really be in those as much if I had that full motion and had my mechanics was easier, you know, like you think that sometimes. Sure. I'm sure I developed some weird habits to allow me to compensate. But anyway, that was one of the injuries. I had a really good experience in PT, pushed me super hard. I hate to say this, but not like your standard PT you would go to, which yeah. I hate that I even have to say that. Super good. Like they were not afraid to like, hey, you have pain. That's cool. As long as it's not flaring up, as long as it's not getting inflamed for days after, like you're an athlete, you got to push you. So I had a great experience. And then I tore my lateral meniscus, the outside of my knee, on my left knee, playing summer ball with my buddies, literally right before my senior year in college. Like I know I was playing like the best basketball of my life. Like,
of course,
going out of my,
always
out of my
the case,
year,
right?
We went to the national championship my junior year. Took a month off to, I don't know, be depressed about it.
Right.
And then was playing summer ball, and like literally I was like, I'm gonna tear it up. Like that summer I was playing the best I'd ever played in my life, and then I was going full speed on this breakaway, and I twisted. Cause somebody like cut me off and I twisted to hand it off to my buddy full speed. And when my foot planted, I didn't pivot. And so my whole like force of my femur on my tibia, just all that rotation, I could feel it pop. ACL tear, but like immediately I was running up and down the floor and it felt like I had a balloon in my leg just almost immediately. There wasn't swelling, but it felt like that really heavy, but I had no idea what happened. I thought like, oh, I can keep playing. So I actually kept playing a little bit, but then I was like, I can't do this anyway. Man. Had to get a surgery for that. Didn't get a repair. Got a meniscectomy, so got some of it taken out. And then when I had the surgery, I did rehab without surgery first. Was doing great. Was back to like almost ready to go back with a pretty significant size tear. Super pumped. And then I went down to I don't know how familiar you are with Southern California like pickup basketball and stuff, but Laguna Beach, you know, the half courts down there. You're familiar with that area?
Yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah.
Really good pickup games down there on Saturday mornings early. And so I was like, screw this. Like, and you know what? Now I would have done it differently because I know better. But
right.
when you're 20 years old and you're like, it's time to go. I was like, all right, I've been working all this stuff in PT, and little did I know all that stuff is controlled, right? I go to this outdoor concrete court and I'm like, let's go 3-on-3. Like, let's go hard. And my knee flares up for like 2 weeks, like huge, like horrible pain. Can't even barely move my knee. So I go back to the surgeon. He's like, you know what? Let's just take it out. That as much, as little as possible, but took it out. And then I ended up playing my first game because that was right before season was, my preseason was going to be starting. I think I played my first game like 6 weeks after surgery, which again, I would have done it differently, but it's my senior year. And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to play, I don't know if I want to play basketball after my senior year as much as I love it. I was like, my sights are set on PT school. I don't know if I want to try to go play professionally somewhere at a lower level, like league or something. So I was like, screw this. I got to get back there as fast as I can. And the first couple of games I did great, but then it was like the whole year was kind of this like managing the injury. Which kind of sucked. So I had the potential to have a lot better year than my junior year, but my junior year I think was better overall just because I was healthier. So I was kind of managing this knee thing throughout the whole year. But long story short, sorry for all the rambling. Hopefully that's okay.
That's what we want.
That's what we do. We ramble.
Perfect. So long story short, all that stuff just kind of solidified my want to become physical therapist.
Yeah.
And I actually didn't even know what I wanted to do until my sophomore year of college. And they like were forcing you to declare a major. And I'm like, I don't know. But I was like, well, what do I like to do? I've always been into sports. I've always been into athletics. I've always been into working out. Like since I was like 14 years old and my dad took me to the gym at 5 in the morning, we would go my freshman year of high school, just always going to the gym. Like, I love to lift. I love to work out. And I was like, you know what? Fitness, sports, exercise, and the fact that I've been through these injuries and seeing, like, how amazing it feels to come back, I'm like,
yep.
And something that's, like, a career that I feel like you can't really go wrong in if you do it the right way.
Yeah.
Like, I'm doing physical therapy. And so you can ask my teammates. It's hilarious. My junior and senior year, we would be playing like rival schools, like huge games, packed. Now, when I say packed arenas, obviously, like Azusa Pacific, I think we hold like maybe 5,000-6,000. And so it gets pretty loud and big.
Yeah.
But we'd have games like that. And I would literally be in the locker room getting my ankles taped. Everybody else is like focusing on the game, listening to headphones. I would have 2-inch thick neurobiology notes highlighting things, studying for my test the next day. And people were like, dude, what are you doing? This is like our rival game. And I'm like, I have a test tomorrow. Like, I gotta kill this thing. This is my life coming up. And I would still go out and get like 16 points
and have a
good game. Because to me, I'm like, if I don't do this, I'm going to be more stressed out in the game. If I'm ready, I'm going to be like, all right, let's do this. Once the buzzer goes off, like, let's go. You know?
Totally. I love that.
It's just funny because people didn't understand. Like, we'd be like in the car, people would be telling jokes, you know, like that, the banter that goes on in the bus. And I would, of course, like love to be involved with that when I can, but there are times I'd be like, dude, guys, I'm putting my headphones in. I got to study. So that was my life for the last 2 years.
Yeah. You knew what was coming next for you. And it was also in a way that is hard to understand for some, but comforting for you to just sort of have all your ducks in a row for that exam tomorrow helped you be prepared for that game.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it prepared me too for PT school after, because I was so used to grinding and like, you got to work your butt off it was a physical therapy, but it was almost like a pre-med. Like people I was in class with were like, literally like, we're going to become scientists. We're going to become like medical doctors. And so just being around those people and like some really freaking smart people, and you're kind of like, I got to be on their level too. Whereas some people that came into the physical therapy graduate school, and there's nothing against this, but they're doing like kinesiology or applied exercise science. And the major was a lot easier to get through. I think just kind of having that grind and trying to balance that with being a college athlete, especially when you're one of the key players on the team my last couple of years.
Right.
Like that just kind of, when I went to PT school, I talked to my colleague about this recently and we were laughing because some of the people that were in the class, and again, nothing to take away from anybody, but people that were in those other majors or didn't play a sport or something, sometimes they'd be like kind of stressed out, like, this is crazy how much stuff we have to do. And I was looking at some of my other classmates that were in the same undergrad as me and were like, this is not that. Not that I'm saying it wasn't hard at times, but like, we're like, I've been doing this for like the last couple of years and playing basketball. Now I don't have to play basketball. Like, this is
right.
Great.
Right.
I'm gonna focus on school and have a good time with my classmates.
Easy money.
It was kind of like, we've done this before. So
totally. Yeah. Been there, done that. I want you to zoom in on something that you said earlier as you air quoted and said, I hate to have to even say this, but it wasn't your standard PT. I know what you're talking about there, but crack that open and talk through what you mean by that, because it's like any profession, and I'll at least put the ball on the tee for you. It's like any profession. People think that all PTs are created equal and it's all the same no matter which one you go to, but they're just not. There's levels to this shit.
Yeah. So what I mean by that is that, and I hope I'm wrong with, and I'm making a generalization that is not there as much anymore, but I think I'm right just from seeing it.
There are so many
clinics that, number one, it's not always the clinician's fault, because insurance is a huge player in this, and the reimbursements are not very good for PTs. And so you end up, the quality of care goes down, because what happens, you go to these clinics and these PTs are having to manage like 4+ people at one time.
Right.
They have an aide who does not have a degree. I mean, they don't have a degree, but they don't need to have a degree.
That's right.
It's basically a PT has trained this aide to go through certain exercises, how to perform them, quote, correctly. But the aide has no idea how to like modify for things. They might have little tricks, but they don't really understand like what the person's going through, what pathology they have, what they're recovering from, what the precautions are. And what happens is the PT kind of goes, oh, here's the exercises they're going to do. And they come in, the PT might spend 5 to sometimes maybe 15 minutes with them just to do some manual therapy work that they might not even need, might not even be appropriate
right.
For that person. just to do something that they can bill for to make money, and then pass them off to the aide that goes and works out for them for like an hour. And again, that aide is probably managing like 8 people at once or 10 people at once. So it's just, what ends up happening is the quality of care becomes super poor. And so much of the time too is there's a lot of modalities that are used. Now, so I'm not totally against modalities, but a lot of times it's just modalities where either the literature shows it doesn't really do very much, or again, there's so much time is spent on just rubbing somebody's knee with an ultrasound unit when that person could be spending more time doing something that's more meaningful to whatever their goals are. Now, like I said, like if somebody has the time, like if a PT is spending a lot of time with a person and giving them the quality of care they should be giving them, and there's some modalities there to help with pain relief and stuff, and it's evidence-based stuff, I have no issues with that. The person has the time and they're getting what they need. But if that's like the only thing you're doing and the PT's barely seeing you and there's barely any assessment and they're giving you just like a cookbook of exercises rather than actually doing an assessment to see what you actually need to be doing or should be prioritizing, that's a huge problem. And unfortunately, so many people go through this and then they think, PT doesn't work. PT doesn't, like, this stuff is just crap. Like, I'd rather just go to my trainer, rather go to my chiropractor. And again, I don't have anything wrong with chiros or personal trainers, but I mean, it's embarrassing what happens a lot in our profession.
It is. I'm exactly with you. One of the things I want you to go a little further on is the idea of, you brought up, of overdone manual therapy or modality therapy strategies versus active or exercise-based prescription, why that might be. And then maybe an example that's top of mind for you of a common modality that we need to myth bust a little bit here.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically what happens is somebody might have like, a painful knee or something.
Yeah.
And they have issues like squatting or going up and down stairs, right? Really common thing. And the majority of the time is spent with like rubbing around the knee and the muscles in there when it maybe has nothing to do with the muscles being sore, but just to say like, ooh, I'm doing something to your knee, when that person might like not have anything, any strain or anything like that, or any soreness in the muscles, it's actually like within the joint. And it's like, why are we rubbing the knee when we could be like working on maybe some joint mobility stuff if they're stiff, or working on improving their tolerance to maybe stepping up and down a step at a lower level, or some wall sits, or some other like hip and thigh and hamstring, like quad and hamstring strengthening to build up the resilience and their strength. So that's like one example of that. And then as far as like a modality thing, I mean, the first thing that pops in my mind would be like an ultrasound unit. And we know that like, that really doesn't, compared to if the machine, it could be on or off, and any results that somebody is getting, I mean, it does heat up the tissue. We know it does heat up the tissue, but actually, does it really do much to help with healing? No, it doesn't do really anything. And people can actually, I don't know if there's studies or it's more like anecdote stuff where people are like, well, keep the machine off. And they do the ultrasound, and people are like, oh my gosh, it feels so much better after you do that. And they're like, I didn't even turn it on. I was just rubbing the ear.
Good old placebo.
Yeah, exactly, right? The placebo effect, placebo is actually awesome if you think about it. Placebo is great.
The fact that if it works,
actually get better. But if placebo is happening and somebody believes that something is doing something it's not doing, and then they become reliant on that thing, that's where it like becomes an issue.
Good point.
And then another thing I wanted to mention, and this would be right up your alley, Tim, like when you work with athletes, high-level athletes that are like killing their body every day, it's different than maybe somebody who's seen like the average person who's maybe not as active or whatever, right? So if somebody's like super active and they're just beat up and they have a 82 game season and like they're, you're not going to be like, all right, let's get crazy on the exercise. I mean, they do need to like work out, but if they're in the middle of the season, like I don't have anything wrong. Like if somebody feels good and relaxed and like you do like massage and stuff like that to help those guys out, like that stuff's great. There's nothing wrong with that. Right. But like if it's somebody who's super sedentary, who doesn't really do much, and like you're spending all your time doing that, and it's like, well, they don't really do any movement or exercise. Like, you know what I'm saying? There's a disconnect there. So like the guys that are in season and stuff, like, yeah, you can do a lot of stuff to help them feel better, get some relief, just feel more relaxed, just like kind of tone things down. But yeah, you might do some some little accessory exercises to help them out, but you're not going to like work them super hard when they're already beat
crush
up.
Them.
You, you have to use your clinical reasoning.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of people that are like anti manual therapy and modality. And I'm like, well,
depends.
It can be helpful. And you just got to give the right message. You got to give the right narrative. You can't, you know what I'm saying? So,
yeah, case by case, it depends. And I think that it also depends on the individual. It depends on, or is this person somebody who's chronically hyper aware or hyper toned in their body and always sort of in this on mode, and that person needs a little bit of the more passive work. Like you said, are they in a season of sport and they're getting crushed every day in different practices, games, or weight room sessions, and we don't need to cake on to that? And I think even in that environment, there is sort of the sometimes the sort of other end of it is where players can use that as an excuse sometimes to say, well, I'm in season. I'm not really going to spend a lot of time in the weight room. I'm not going to do these sessions. So the other end of it is be careful of sort of going to the other all the way over and saying, I'm just going to get table time, so to speak. And I'm just going to get the passive work. And I'm going to, in the off season, I'll work really hard, because there's a sweet spot like anything else. There's a voice of reason and there's a happy medium that you do need to top off the bucket. As I always tell a person who's in season is, look, you're not going to go three sessions hard doing tons of plyos and things like that in a season. Yeah. But you can't also just get the massage and do the ice baths and do some passive stretching and that kind of thing and think that your body's going to be able to hold up for this season.
Totally. So you have to, that's where you have to have a good coach, right?
Exactly.
Like you.
Yeah. Like you.
To program, right?
So yeah.
That you're maintaining what they've gained in the off season, keeping them as strong and resilient as you can without overworking them, which is a fine balance. You have to probably read each guy and how the team's doing overall and stuff like that. But I remember too, when I was playing and I'd be like, oh my God, we got to go to the weight room. Like, and I like to lift. I like, a lot of guys like did not like to lift. They just wanted to play. And I totally like to lift weight. Like, I freaking love it. But I would be like, oh, you serious? We have to go to the weight. But then you go and I wouldn't be lifting near the numbers I was in the preseason or off season.
Sure.
But like, just the fact that I got in there and did something, we spent like 30 minutes circuit train or whatever, or just spent time on like three big lifts, but not super high intensity.
Right.
But just enough to get a stimulus to help us out. I mean, you did go, wow, actually that was good. I'm glad coach had us do that, you know?
Right. So. I remember. Yeah, exactly. I remember being the same way, like, oh man, especially early on my freshman year playing in small division three school outside of Boston here, Endicott College. And it was sort of, we had to lift before practices sometimes, and I hadn't done that or sort of let my body adapt and accommodate to that stimulus before a practice. So you kind of at first are feeling like you're shooting a medicine ball when you first try to get out of those lifts, and then your body does adapt. It accommodates to that stimulus. And then as Ogere Streeter talked about on his episode with us, a great physical therapist in the Pacific Northwest area, he talked about the fact that don't forget your shot, because there is this myth that basketball players have, like, if I lift too heavy, too hard, and especially upper body, it's going to mess up my shot. Yes. And so he really kind of debunked it really nicely and was just sort of like, don't forget the jump off the ground or the balance that you have in the air or how rapidly you could get your shot off and on balance from your core to your upper body through your hips is all going to be much more on point when you are lifting properly the right way regularly. So it actually in many ways could help. Plus, besides the fact that Ray Allen and JJ Redick, and I could go on down the list of these great shooters who lifted hard and heavy their whole NBA career and set NBA records behind the arc, it is the case. And so I think that there is sort of that aspect of once you get through that plateau of letting your body, that's the cool part about the body to me, is that it does have the ability to adapt and accommodate to stimulus, and then it will happen. It's just got to get through that first part of it.
Yeah. And it's funny you mentioned that whole myth thing, because I almost forgot about that, because it's been like a while now. And it's such an outside of my mind that, like, to me, I'm like, I can lift and I can shoot. Like, I'm never going to lose my touch. There. I don't even play ball much anymore. And like, I go in the gym and I shoot around for like 30 minutes and I'm like, it's almost back. Like, you know what I'm saying? But it's just funny because, like, I remember thinking that and being like, oh God, this can mess up my shot. And I think maybe a lot of that has to do with, I mean, people just think common sense, like you're getting bigger muscles and
yes.
you're going to like overshoot and you're going to brick and you don't have that soft touch anymore. Plus, if you shoot right after you lift, like you said, if you feel weird and you don't understand like what's actually going on in your body, you might think like, oh, wow, look at how bad my shot is right after I lift. And it's like, well, that's just because you just lifted and you're fatigued and like you, your central nervous system is like raring to go. And you know what I'm saying? Like, you give it some time and you're going to, your touch will be right back where it is.
Absolutely.
And in my experience, and a lot of guys would know this, is like when you're lifting consistently, especially when you're doing a lot of like anything like full body stuff, but especially like pushing exercises, tricep exercises, that kind of stuff. Like, it's so nice to feel like, man, I don't have to work that hard. I just need to focus on my wrist, really. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You get the motion down, and when you're lifting and you're strong, it's like you, I literally would just tell myself, like, I just need to focus on my wrist. Obviously, my whole body, I was shooting, I shot thousands and thousands and thousands of shots over my life. So right. my body's still working. But like, because it's so natural to do that motion, I don't think about getting that much power, really. I just do the motion and I think about like, what's the touch like on my wrist? Am I a little bit long? Okay, I'm going to let my, like, not going to snap my wrist as hard. You know, that's what helped me out. And just making sure I was rolling off the right finger every time. And then it would just be like, it's like clockwork once you get that down, right?
That's such a good point. It becomes effortless if you're just now fine tuning the fine motor aspect of the action. If the mechanical pieces are strong enough to support you from literally your feet up, it just does become this flick of the wrist, this effortless thing.
Yeah. It's just, it's crazy how that works. Is you overthink too many things all at once and it screws it. If you just focus on like one little, like you said, like fine motor thing, it's so much easier than focusing on like, okay, am I getting down in that right position? Am I elbowing? Am I, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
But you work on that all the time. But then when you get in the game, you just need to make little mini adjustments and you'll be fine.
Yeah, that's absolutely so true. Speaking of myths, I saw that you posted a while ago something that TD and I have done a blog post about and have discussed, you know, a little bit offline as well, which is around, I can't do deadlifts anymore because my doctor says they're bad for my back, or I can't do squats anymore because, you know, my doctor says, or so-and-so says, or I read somewhere that they're bad for my knees. And we start excluding the, you know, entire movement archetypes. And you had a little riff on that yourself. So could you take us inside beneath the surface of the initial, oh crap, not this again response that you might have when somebody brings that up, how would you kind of counter that? And you know, what's a better way to think about these kind of things?
Yeah, so I try to provide as much nuance as I can for people that I'm trying to educate online, but also like patients and clients that see me. So what I always say is number one, I don't want to badmouth the doctor, whoever told them that. What I might say is, hey, you know what? They don't necessarily have the same training that I do, just like I don't have the same training they do. So if they're telling you in their 5 to 10 minutes they spend with you, because they're so busy, so many doctors, right? In that small amount of time that they have to spend with you, they're thinking, what can I do to make this, to help make sure this person does not get worse? And so maybe what they're thinking is like, hey, just, you got to stop squatting. You got to stop running. You got to stop doing this stuff. And it's not really that helpful for the person,
right?
Because they're like, what? I can't do this anymore. But in the doctor's mind, they're like, hey, I don't know what to tell them other than like, stop doing this stuff. And it's, and like, give it some time. And it's very general advice. And a lot of them, I think, are really doing their best. I think some of them, maybe they might think they understand it more than they do in this field.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of them too really do mean the best. They just don't have the time to really explain things, or they don't know how to, because it's not their area of expertise. But then what I'll do is I'll explain to the person like, hey, you have to view this movement. You can't view things as like black and white. So you can't say like, let's talk about like squats and knee pain, right? Like, you can't say a squat is bad for your knee, because there's people do it all day, every day, just getting up and out of a chair, right? You go downstairs, you up and downstairs. You can't say it's bad for your knee. What you can say is, hey, you know what? Right now it looks like this movement is making your knee more sensitive, or you're sensitive to this movement and these loads.
Mm.
So then when you do that, you take away this black and white, good and bad thing. And you say, hey, there's different colors of the spectrum here, right? It's gray. So you can still squat probably, but you know what? You might only be able to squat this distance. If you go a little bit lower, this is your sensitive point. You need to, let's learn how we can modify and work around this. So then the person goes, oh, squatting's not bad for my knees. I just right now, maybe for a little while, these specific positions and loads might not be the best for my knee because it's aggravating it. Or maybe with as much weight as I have on the bar, if I take some more weight off, I can get to that depth, you know? Right. Or maybe I do need to sit back more so there's less pressure on my knees. I'm putting more load on my hips and my spine because those areas are not sensitive. So I'm going to take some pressure off my knees. Let's let the body calm down. Let's work on some other accessory stuff. And then my body, then I'll slowly expose myself to those previously aggravating positions and movements. And the body is pretty amazing at adapting and getting less sensitive and going, and then also building up your confidence as you go through those movements again. So that way the person goes like, oh, I see why that's a problem right now, but it doesn't need to be a problem forever or something that I need to fear or avoid forever.
Yeah, that is dead on. And I would just add something that you brought up earlier. If you're talking about the squat pattern, another alternative too is to say, okay, if the dynamic nature, say we as you talked about, kind of cut back on the range and there was still a little bit of crankiness that was coming during a lower, smaller range squat, well, you could put them into a wall sit as you brought up earlier. And look, the wall sit is just a isometric static version of a squat pattern. And you could go to different heights of a wall sit. You don't have to go down to 90 degrees like your gym teacher used to yell at you for getting down lower at or whatever it is. You can start up high and just work that loading of those tissues. I think people either don't realize sometimes or just need a reminder sometimes. And this is even, like you said, medical doctors and people that think about maybe aren't in the trenches of how we get these tissues in these areas to respond that might be cranky from time to time, but tendons, ligaments, bones, and also muscles. But we forget that those other support structures, those tissues respond really well and like to be loaded and strengthened too, if we do them in the right ways. If we find the right starting point, start from the start is something we always talk about, and then work your way, because as you said, that is the incredible part of the body. It has an uncanny way of adapting and becoming more resilient in response to load. There's laws about it. There's physical laws about it called Wolf's Law for bone and things like that, yeah, where when you load it, the bone gets stronger, or tendon as well. And it will find ways to increase its tolerance of certain activities. Your point being so perfect that we cannot just say this movement, this pattern, you should not do it. It's bad for you, or it's bad in general, because that happens way too much.
Yeah. And I think what you said too about, going back to the medical doctor thing, sometimes if people aren't quite understanding what I'm saying, and it's not the best analogy, but what I'll say is I'll like, okay, imagine you get, and a lot of people that see me, they don't like to take medication, but I'm like, imagine you go to a doctor and they give you medication and they say, you have to take 3 pills a day for this to help your issue. And the person takes one a day, and then they're not like, why am I not getting better, doc? And then you're like, well, it says on the bottle to take 3 a day. So if you're underloading, you're not doing enough, you might not get the improvements you want. So if you're avoiding things, but then it's like, if you take a handful of them, right, you're probably going to have a lot of bad side effects. You're going to flare up your knee if you load it too much, or you're going too quickly with your velocity. You're letting your knees maybe go further past your toes than maybe they're ready for, or whatever.
Yeah.
So like you got to, I always be like, hey, if you have the right dose, then we shouldn't have these negative side effects, and it should also be helpful. It shouldn't feel like it's doing nothing. And that dose, The difference between maybe medication and movement and loading and stuff is that dose can change a lot over time whereas medication is usually like you need this exact dose. But they get the idea. People tend to get that a lot better.
That analogy is beautiful. That's awesome. That's so perfect. And I think that what you also bring up there is this idea that the poison is the dose. It's not the medicine that's being applied. The poison is in the amount or the intensity or an error in the range of motion that was attempted at first, or volume of total work, all that kind of stuff. It's not necessarily to say, and I talk about this a lot with people that we work with, it's not that exercise that you felt pain either during or shortly thereafter was is bad for you or the problem. It just was either the weight being used, the amount that you used with it, that in terms of reps and sets, and you may have jumped in a little too much. Oftentimes, well, you did this with your meniscus, right? I mean, you jump back into those Laguna Beach games and it just was a lot all at once before you had sort of built up the tolerance of it. It wasn't playing basketball that you had to stop doing for good. It was just, had you dosed the basketball activities more properly or more accurately at that moment, you may not have had that flare up. And who knows, like you said, you may not have had to get that surgery at that moment.
And it's water under the bridge now, but like looking back, I think of those things like, man, maybe I could have lived with that meniscus tear and been fine because I was doing so well in that controlled environment, but I hadn't really done much uncontrolled stuff. And I went to like full level uncontrolled playing where you're making reactions and you're on this hard surface. It's like, if I wouldn't have went back to it, I would have been like, I would have got a friend. I would have played some one-on-one.
Yeah.
Would have done a little, you know what I'm saying? I would have slowly done stuff that was a little bit more uncontrolled, trying to more reactive stuff, probably done stuff on a wood floor first with some spring to it before I went to the concrete or the asphalt or whatever. But as a 20-year-old who was not a PT yet, I didn't know. I'm like, they cleared me. I'm good. Like, I look how hard I've been working. Like, of course I could go play.
Absolutely. Like, no. And it happens all the time.
And I would say even myself at that time probably did it better than most people would do it. But
I'm sure
even that wasn't what I should have done. You know what I'm saying? So
totally. And when we look at what causes an injury, a re-injury or a flare-up or an injury in the first place, you oftentimes can go back to looking at this, what's called your acute to chronic workload ratio. What that means is, what is the sort of day-to-day that you've been doing over the last month of amount of workload in that joint area, in that body area? And then that's sort of that chronic where it sits if we were tracking it on a graph, let's say. And then acute is what you do yesterday, today, tomorrow. Is there a big spike from what your chronic is to your acute? Is there a big gap? All of a sudden, there's this huge spike of acute workload. That's a great, excellent, perfect, proven recipe for an injury, re-injury, or a flare-up. And so that's just what we can take away from that is you need to think about how you dose your return to sport, just like we talked about dosing and exercise in reps and sets and that kind of thing. Our body's really cool that it can adapt and accommodate, but it cannot tolerate and it doesn't do well with big spikes of workload and intensities of workload and volumes of workload that are out of the norm within a 1-3 day period or a 1 week period. It has to happen very slowly.
Yeah. And I think it's tough for a lot of people, even if you tell them, you need to tell them day one, it's still tough for people to take that and go, okay, I'm okay with this. Or if they say that
right
a month or two later, they're getting frustrated and you go, hold on, we talked about this.
Yeah.
But we, and I think a lot of it has to do with, we live in a world where everything is very like quick results.
Yep.
I want this stuff to happen now. If I'm paying for this, I want the results now. I want it to be on my doorstep within a day or two, Amazon Prime, like, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so it's very tough for people to accept the fact that like, hey, you could be seeing the best physical therapist in the entire world.
Yeah.
And maybe the other 100 best right behind him, they might all give you something similar, but you can't skip your body's like progression and how it's going to adapt and heal and recover. No matter how perfect your plan is, there's going to be this rate limiting step that you got to be okay with.
You can't fast forward it. That just physiologically, it'll stop you.
That's why, I mean, just a basketball reference here. Like, that's why it was really cool to me. Not that he had a couple injuries, big injuries, but to see how long it took like Klay Thompson to come back. I think that was actually, it was really cool to see like, hey, he's really taking his time here rather than just trying to rush back because he sees the big picture and hopefully he's, and he probably got the right advice from people.
No, that is such a good example. And talk about the tragic or bad alternative to that when we talk about things like, well, Klay had the ACL. So get into that for a second, because we see this sort of camp of hopefully we're getting away from it, but we have had what I've seen in the space of where we are at and in youth sports and that kind of thing, where you'll get And you talked about it earlier. Hey, doc cleared me. And there's this disconnect of what the doctor clears them. Their clearance is from like, well, I did the surgery. I know what I'm looking for at this stage. Looks good. You're cleared. To then what they actually need, that athlete needs to be prepared for from training and then sport standpoint. It's not the doctor's fault. That's just not the trench that they're in all the time. They don't see exactly what they need to be ready for. So ACLs, you just see this thing where I see this thing too often for my liking, where it's this, I get this a lot where a kid comes in and they say they're at 6, 7, maybe 8 months, and I know where they're at, and I'm thinking not quite at the point where the baking time is up for return to sport, but they say, had my doctor's appointment yesterday. They said I could actually go back to practice.
Yeah.
Talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, so I think what happens a lot of times with surgeons and doctors is their job is to, let's follow up with them at, a lot of times it's like a 6 month point or something. And they want to make sure like, hey, if I check the ACL laxity or compare the mobility side to side, is it still good? And they'll have like these pretty simple tests. Some of them will have them do like a single leg squat or squat or step down, and they're not seeing a lot of valgus, like knee caving in and stuff like that. And they'll be like, all right, you're good to go. And some of them that are a little bit better will still have them do some sort of like hop tests or something like that. But even that, it's like, we know, like, you can't just look at those things in isolation and go like, all right, like off you go. Like there's so much, that's just like the entryway to like, all right, let's slowly integrate you back into doing some drills lightly and getting your confidence up. And then there's like the whole psychological aspect. Are they psychologically ready to go? And there's like forms we can have them fill out and stuff like that. But like you said, it's like, that's you can't really blame them. I mean, I guess I wouldn't want to say blame is the right word, but like they shouldn't be just saying, hey, you can go back, but you can't, but you can't blame them for not having that expertise of knowing when I'd rather the doctor be like, hey, on my end, you don't really need to see me anymore. You're good. I'm going to clear you from seeing me. I'm happy with your recovery. Everything's healed. And that'll be good for the patient to hear like, hey, the doctor doesn't need to see me anymore. And then the doctor goes, hey, go to your PT. Now you guys are going to slowly get back to your sport. You shouldn't be going back yet. Let's work with your PT. They will take the reins now, as far as like when you're ready, but on my end, you're clear, you know?
Well, that's such a good way to put it. And I think it sort of brings to light that this does have to improve in both sides. It's not like this is all the doctor's fault. It's also on the PTs on their side, because if the doctors start doing that and they do a good job the way that you described it of saying on my end, you're cleared, but I need you to go to Caleb, and Caleb's going to take you through a battery that I don't usually do in the office here. That'll tell us a little bit more about the functional performance and tolerance of where you're at from your quad strength, your quad hamstring ratio strength, and where you are at from a jump landing standpoint and all that stuff. Look, I don't do that in my doctor's office here, but Caleb will do that. And then the two of us will give you both a thumbs up when we feel like we've seen both what we need to see. It takes the PTs on their side to be really aware of what those proven, valid, reliable tests are that show us more about like when an ACL is ready. And then there's the feel side. And then on top of that, which you brought up, there's the psychological side, because you could have an athlete clear all of that stuff and do it really properly and still just feel like, I'm not quite there. We had Jelani Williams on, who had 3 ACL tears in a 5-year period, plays for Penn. And it just was a brutal sort of process that he went into in depth in his episode earlier with us. And one of those returns, he did get cleared. And I think cleared in that particular case of his 3, that one where he probably had done the baking time and it was going to be ready based on time and what he explained to me he was doing in those things, but he didn't feel ready. That was the first of the 3, and he hadn't sort of grappled with what it was going to be like to play. And he said, I'm going to put up my stop sign here because I'm not ready to go back. And so I think that there's all those things that have to happen right. And I think sometimes we're just glazing over. All it takes is I got to go back for that 6-month doc checkup. If they say good, then what am I still going to PTs for? Or why do I still need to go to that strength coach or that trainer? Because doc said I'm good and I'm ready to practice. I'm dying to get out there.
Yeah. And that, again, that kind of goes to, I think a lot of PTs need to be better about, like, not like having a power trip, but like understanding your role and owning it.
That's right.
And not, I think I have seen PTs where a doctor might say the person's clear, and then the PT is like, all right, well, you passed my test. Or the doctor says you're clear, like, okay, off you go. Rather than being like, hold on, I'm going to give the doctor a call. Like, you're not ready, you know?
Yeah.
And being like, hey, this is my expertise.
That's right.
Like, you know, this is what I do. And so I can't have somebody who that's not their expertise, like, saying you can go back to doing this stuff when that's not their area of expertise.
Well, yeah. And it's not to start a turf war, but what it would be like is if you or I were going in to say, I think you're going to want to cut over there on your surgery. It's we have an idea of the anatomy. Yeah. I mean, but
you have an idea of, like, this guy might have a meniscus tear, but you know what? I don't look at the imaging. I've been trained in that, but not to nearly the level an ortho doc has.
Totally.
I have no idea, like, how to do the surgery. Like, it's just like, hey, I suspect there might be something intra-articular in the joint.
Totally.
Can you take a look at it? You're the expert in that. Help me out here, right?
Totally.
And so you have that collaboration, and that's a beautiful thing when you have that.
How do you frame expectations of the rehab process for them, for a person that you start to work with out of the gates, where, as you said, sometimes people have a bad taste of PT in the past, or they don't really understand the timeline that is necessary to get this thing unraveled and back together.
It's almost like when you see a friend that you saw in high school and you haven't seen them for 10 years, and then you see them and you're like, holy crap, you know what I mean? Right. You're like a completely different person. But if you see that person every single day, you might not even know, they might not look much different to you. But if you haven't seen them in 10 years, it's going to be a huge difference. So it's the same thing when you're looking at your rehab. You kind of, like, you don't want to get caught up in the day-to-day stuff, and there could be ups and downs. I'll even use an analogy. Like, it's kind of like, some people don't get this because I'm not into this, but, like, the stock market can go up and down and all over the place.
Yeah.
But the key is to not freak out when stuff goes down or get too excited and giddy when things go up. You got to look at the long-term trend. And so if the long-term trend is going up, even if you have some pitfalls, then we're on the right track. And I also want to set them up and say, like, you know what? You're probably going to have some bad days. You're probably going to have a bad week here or there. Maybe when we're starting to push you harder with your return to sport stuff, we might have a little flare up because we have to test it out. We can't baby it too much, right? That we don't want that to happen, but you might have these little things happen as you're pushing you to that next level. And as long as they're aware of that, then what happens is you set these expectations so that when it eventually inevitably does happen, that they are not freaking out about it. Like, oh, he told me this might happen. Okay. Like, let me give it some time. We'll get right back on the horse. Let's do this thing. If you don't set them up for that, you could be shooting yourself and them in the foot, because now all these thoughts go into their head, which I don't blame them for, because they don't know any better. You might think, wow, I'm screwed. My knees, like, I might need surgery again. But if somebody tells you, no, you might have these little things here and there, it's totally fine. Like,
yeah,
you know what? Your body will bounce back. Then it really, really helps that process.
That's so good. And that's the piece where I think is just so critical to somebody's experience in the rehab process being just what it should be, which is, hey, when those ebbs, flows, dips in the market or spikes in the market come, we've already talked about it. We knew that was going to come. It's not going to be a linear process. And as soon as people start to recognize that, it's so much more of a fruitful, enjoyable, and successful process, because there isn't this sort of, like you said, psychological kind of, here we go, I'm going back to ground zero. I cannot believe today's a little bit worse than I think yesterday was. Whereas if they compared Wednesday this week to Wednesday last week, they've actually made some big progress. And so I think that's so, so critical.
One more thing I want to add on there that's super huge, and I try to tell everybody too, is I try to explain them, especially, like, because a lot of things we see are, like, pain related, trying to help somebody do things with less pain.
Yeah.
I try to explain to them that they can't just look at if pain is less or if it's gone. Because if all they're focusing on is pain, number one, if they just think about pain being gone, they're always going to be, like, mad about it or upset that it's not gone, because they're gonna be like, what the heck, it's still there, it's the same. And it's like, even if it's much less, or the amount of time it's there is less, or the intensity is less, or you know what I'm saying, or how often it comes on per week. If even if that stuff is so much better, if to them, if they still have it, nothing has changed because it's either like this on or off. So that's one huge thing I want to tell people right off the bat. The other thing I try to tell them too is don't just look at pain as a metric of if you're getting better. If pain is staying the same, it's not getting worse, but you can tolerate a lot more activity. You can do a lot more things for longer, and you look at it as from like a functional standpoint and you're improving, but pain is not necessarily making any huge changes, but you can tolerate these things. And the tissue is not actually getting injured, then that's also a huge step too. So if you take their focus off of, oh, my pain's not gone. Yeah, it's still there, but you know what? Look at all the stuff I can do now. That's huge. And then they start to look at that as like, they're super happy. And they're like, you know what? I have my pain, but look at all the things I can do. And then eventually what ends up happening is they stop focusing on their pain so much. And then one day they go, holy crap, I haven't had pain for a week. You know what I'm saying? I played three games and like, I just had a minor ache, but like, I wasn't even thinking about it. You know, I listened to a podcast a while ago. I can't remember where it was from, but so I can't really take credit for this, but somebody made an amazing point that has always stuck with me since is like the day, especially somebody that's dealt with like a persistent symptom or injury for a long time. And they can't remember the last time they didn't have pain.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks that the day that their pain is quote gone is going to be this like this huge event where they're like, oh, my pain is gone.
Fireworks.
Like, yes. Steady coming down. And it's amazing. When in reality, you won't even know. It just will happen. And then all of a sudden, one day you'll be like, whoa, I didn't even realize that I've been living without pain for the last month. You know what I'm saying? That's how it really works.
Yes.
You just get caught up in life and you don't even realize the fact. That's what happens. That's the point when you are, quote, pain-free and in control of things versus this like light switch on off thing, which people are expecting. That doesn't really happen.
That's so true. So important.
Yeah. What else, in terms of, I mean, we're kind of talking about, interpersonal communication now and soft skills. What else, are some ways that you've developed the kind of either on the leadership end or communication or other parts of your profession as both PT and strength coach that don't involve just mastering the technical aspects of it?
Like, how do I learn about it, or how do I just perform it?
Yeah. Just in terms of your own personal development, you know, as a practitioner and just that again, working on the soft skills, the interpersonal side of what you do.
I think, I mean, one of this, not to sound like I'm being repetitive here, but I mean, a lot of it is just reps and experience and just working with people. I think a lot of clinicians, especially newer clinicians too, get so caught up in trying to do things by the book rather than just remembering that they're a human and people want to like connect with you on a human level and feel comfortable with you rather than you're their physical therapist. They want you to be like they're someone that connects and they get. And they respect you, but you also like understand the crap that they're going through and how they're feeling about things and really just trying to understand people where they're at, I think is huge. And then I think other experiences outside of things you learned in school or like do in the clinic are huge too, right? So for me, I've had to work over the years on my communication with my wife, right? So like I have to, like that is the hardest thing I have to do is to try to always be a good communicator to my wife and understand her. Well, sometimes when I don't understand, like I don't understand, but I have to like explain to her like that I can empathize with what she's going through, but I don't completely understand. But just showing that empathy is huge. So communication with that. And then like other experiences before PT school, like I worked in catering for like 10 years, catering weddings and just interacting with people and doing house parties. One of the coolest jobs, to be honest, because I love food.
Yeah.
My buddy actually, his mom owns like the biggest catering company in Orange County in Southern California and like part of LA. Like it's like very nice, fancy, but like the connection was, hey, I need a job. I'm in high school. I'm in college.
Right.
So that's the other thing. In PT school, not PT school, in undergrad, but mostly in PT school, I was also working on my weekends to have the money for my rent and stuff like that. And I would work
right.
Couple, like Saturday and Sunday usually. and get home at like 2-3 in the morning sometimes.
Yep. Those events go late, man.
Yeah. But I mean, just that interacting with people and just giving good customer service and that kind of stuff that has nothing to do with physical therapy, but you learn those skills along the way about how to interact with people better. And then you can apply that. Like you forget at first, like I go back into PT and I was kind of like robotic, even though it's not me at all. But because you're so focused on doing things the technical right way. But then once you start to get more comfortable with that stuff, you go, hold on, who am I as a person? What have I learned over the years talking with people, providing that customer service and that connection that people really like and will trust you when you give that to them? And then you apply that to your clinical practice and it's huge. It's like ridiculously huge because they, like I said, they'll trust you. They'll give you a break if you make a mistake because they know you're a good guy and you're not just like giving them some cookie cutter thing. And that relationship level is huge.
Man, that's so cool that's where you kind of just honed the skills through the catering jobs that you were taking. I actually grew up working in my mom's catering business and we had to do all parts of it. I also love food. I also love the preparation and the cooking side and the eating side, but there was a big part of what my brother and I had to do was being the server and interacting with guests that we had to figure something out for them or something was off or that kind of thing. And you learn to read people, you learn how to speak to people better and also most importantly listen to people with what they need. If you listen to a patient, a client, a person that you're serving at a catering event, a athlete long enough, they will tell you what they need and what is wrong if you can really truly listen to them. And I credit constantly really looking back at what soft skills, as you said, Phil, have developed for me over time coming out of, had I not had that experience or had a different job growing up as a kid than all those days serving people in my mom's catering business, maybe it takes it a longer sort of rise to get to where I'm at now, but it's definitely really recommended as a way to hone your skills is to get into a service-based job early on. If you're thinking about, look, this is it's a people operation. Whether we're talking about a strength and conditioning coach working for the LA Lakers, a physical therapist at an outpatient clinic somewhere, or anything else, we are here, we are interacting and our ability to interact with people is paramount to the results that we get in my opinion. So that's so cool that we had a similar experience there. Caleb, I want to respect your time. This has been absolutely incredible. We have one famous last question.
I'm really bad with these.
This one's okay. You've been studying your whole life for this one. So this is the Basketball Strong Podcast. And the question is, what does it mean to you to be basketball strong? You can go technical with this, spiritual, emotional, all the above, wherever your mind, heart, and gut takes you.
I think to be basketball strong, as far as what it means to me, is I think it kind of goes down more to the mental part of it. I think you got to have that killer instinct, and you're going to have shooting slumps, you're going to have bad games, but you have a team around you that's going to support you, and you need to be, you got to still put out your best no matter what. You can't get down on yourself. You have to be mentally tough and strong and be ready to hit it hard and have confidence in yourself every single time you get the ball, even if you're not feeling like it, even if you feel like things aren't going your way. To me, that means you're kind of at that peak. If you look at the guys, the best guys that have ever done it, their mentality and their toughness is like next level. Like things can bother them maybe for short periods, but then they turn that into a way to make themselves better, or they'll never shy away from the moment, right? And I will be completely honest. I had some of my regrets from a playing standpoint was getting too in my head, especially as a shooter, right? You have slumps and you start to think like, what the heck? Why isn't anything going in?
Yep.
But when you are basketball strong, right? You have that mentality, that you have that killer instinct, and you always have that confidence in yourself and that confidence in your teammates. To me, that's what it means.
Oh man, I couldn't agree more. That is so, so perfect. And You've lived a basketball strong life. You continue to, and we are all better today from what we just got to a chance to listen to. So tell people though, where they can follow, where they can get so much of the great stuff that you're putting out there and all the stuff that you're up to.
Yeah. So the main platform by far would be Instagram, and it's just Dr. Caleb Burgess with a period in between all of those. And then I have a Twitter account that I'm somewhat active on, same thing, but without the period, cause you can't do that on Twitter. I also have a Facebook page, which is basically just, recycled information from my Instagram.
Sure.
And then I have my website too, which is the same thing, drcalebburgess.com. And then hopefully if I get my act together and I can start doing more stuff on potentially YouTube, potentially a podcast in the future, but that's just kind of like fleeting thoughts in my head. I got to figure out how to be a dad first.
that's critical.
Don't we all?
We'll be ready for the pod and the YouTube, but I'm telling you, I'm learning every day from the other places where you're out there. So if you haven't checked it out, go check it out. And Caleb, thanks so much. This was absolutely great.
Thanks guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed today's show, and we hope you did, please give us a good review on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you listen to podcasts on. And so you never miss a weekly episode, be sure to subscribe and follow. You can find previous episodes on our show website. That's www.basketballstrongpodcast.com. For more basketball performance resources and nagging injury solutions, follow me on Instagram at TD Athletes Edge, and follow Phil at Phil White Books. Until next week's episode, stay basketball strong.